Hello and welcome to this special Big Boat interview. My name is Lucy Dunn and I'm the Content Director at Boat. This week, ahead of Ocean Talks on 12th of June, we're spotlighting a number of individuals tackling our ocean's most urgent environmental challenges. Today, I have the privilege of talking to Dr. Camilla Floros, a leading coral reef specialist with over two decades of experience in marine conservation. She's lead scientist and marine program manager for Oceans Without Borders, an initiative born from a partnership between luxury travel company and Beyond and the conservation non-profit World Impact. We're delighted she'll be joining us as keynote speaker at Ocean Talks. And for those who aren't familiar with the June event, this is an evening which connects super yacht owners, brokers and designers with those in the field of marine conservation for an evening of inspiring talks, exhibits and networking. The event is free and you need to register on our website. So, Dr. Floros, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Lucy. What a great pleasure it is to be chatting with you today.
So let's start at the beginning. Can you take us back to where your passion with coral reefs first began?
Certainly. It started quite a while ago. I didn't grow up at the coast. I grew up in a small farming community in South Africa, but my parents loved to travel. And on one of the many travels up the east coast of Africa, they came across the Bazaruta Archipelago. And they fell in love with it instantly, and they took us there on many, many holidays. I was very fortunate growing up, and that's where I fell in love with coral reefs, their beauty, their abundance. It was just mesmerizing for me as a child. And we went there for many, many years. But the longer we stayed there, the more we interacted with the communities and got to know the islands and the reefs, the more we saw how the different harvesting methods that the communities were using, because they relied on these marine resources for everything. And they were using nets, and the nets were breaking coral. They were dragging these very long nets over the seagrass beds and pulling up all sorts of marine creatures, some of them edible, some inedible, some juvenile, some large. And I just started to ask some questions about, surely there should be a more sustainable way that the communities can use these resources. So I think that was the start where I wanted to protect coral reefs.
And so you've been interested from a very early age. So what other turning points or moments have set you on this path?
So I knew that I wanted to be a marine biologist. So obviously I went off and studied, and I spent 10 years at a research institute, which was fantastic because there I learned the value of data and how conservation, in order to be effective, needs to be evidence-based. After spending a large number of years at a research institute, I went to work with Traffic International, and that was very policy-based, which was also a great learning curve for me, working on a large multinational project. And that really gave me experience to work across multiple cultures. But again, at the very policy level, and I felt that I wanted to be more hands-on. So that led me to my work where I am now with World Impact, running the Oceans Without Borders program, where it's really, I feel, at the grassroots level, and I can have the hands-on at the coalface marine conservation impact that I'm so passionate about.
Yes. So tell me about Ocean Without Borders. So it's a partnership with a travel company called Ambeyond, and then World Impact, who are?
They are the non-profit entity working in collaboration with Ambeyond. So you're absolutely right. Ambeyond is a luxury travel company with its roots in conservation. And then Wild Impact is their NGO non-profit partner who is trying to empower communities. And this partnership came about because the founders of Ambeyond realized that where they were working and where they had these beautiful lodges, they wanted the communities within these areas to also have economic benefits from the conservation. And so they formed this other entity called Wild Impact. Ambeyond has
a footprint in all over Africa and also in Asia, but they also have marine footprints. That's how Oceans Without Borders was established. So within the Bazaruto Archipelago, they have the And Beyond Lodge there, and that's where we are operating to work with communities for marine protection. And again, they have a footprint in Zanzibar on Nemba Island, and we are doing the same thing, working with communities there to try and do as much marine conservation as we can.
So you're back to basically where you went holidayed as a child.
I certainly am, and it's been a journey and something I reflect on often, and something that I'm quite proud about, because yes, I started very young and with this love for these coral reefs and the ocean, and then I went off to varsity and I would tell my friends that I wanted to always end up back in the Bazaruto Archipelago, and I have. So it's something of a personal and a professional milestone for me that I'm quite proud of.
Brilliant. And so what exactly does your work involve?
So we've got a number of areas. As I say, we work within these two very ecologically and biodiverse seascapes in the Bazaruto Archipelago and as well as in Zanzibar and Nemba Island. And they are both hugely important because of the critical habitats that you find there, but also the reliance that local communities have on the marine resources. So we are trying to work with communities, and we are working with a range of stakeholders, right from the Ministry of Blue Economy and other conservation and management authorities like African Parks, to just try and identify the threats and then find solutions to not only mitigate the threats, but to find the most sustainable way for resource use.
So tell me a little bit about, they're two different areas, you say. So tell me a bit about what kind of areas are they and what kind of threats are they having?
So within the Bazaruto Archipelago, it's a vast, vast area. It covers 143,000 hectares. So it's enormous, with five big islands. And it's well known for its megafauna. So it's whales and whale sharks and other sharks and manta rays. It's also known for its dugongs, which are an endangered species, and it's the last viable population of dugongs within the Western Indian Ocean. So a really, really important habitat. How, unfortunately, within the Bazaruto Archipelago, there is a high population of local communities who are living, I would say, right on the breadline. They're very poor communities. There's not a lot of opportunity for alternative livelihoods. So marine resources are so key in their lives for generating revenue, whether it's through little tourism operators or whether it's relying on them directly for protein. So resource pressure in terms of fisheries is a really key threat within the Bazaruto Archipelago.
Okay, great. A lot of your work involves empowering local marine rangers. Tell me a bit about that.
It certainly does. We have what we call community and conservation rangers, and they are at the heart of our work. Wherever we operate, we work with partner communities. That is really at the core of what we do. So we recruit our rangers, our marine rangers from the surrounding communities, and then we upskill them so that they lead in our marine activities. We could not operate without them. They are our champions. They are our stewards. So they scuba dive, they drive our boats, they do our monitoring. They are now currently in Nemba Island welding our artificial structures and our sea stars for our restoration purposes. There's certainly been some challenges along the way within our Zanzibar seascape. Across all our seascapes, we really want equal opportunities for male and female rangers. But in Zanzibar in particular, that was quite a challenge because it was not the norm within the Zanzibar culture to have female rangers, but we persisted. And now we have two female rangers who are driving boats, who are welding, who are doing reef restoration, who are obviously scuba diving, and we want to recruit more.
And they're all local to the area.
Absolutely. They are our identified key partner communities, and they're very much local to the area because we believe that by having these community and conservation rangers leading on our activities, they are our voice of marine conservation. They can take that message back to the communities way better than we can do.
Yeah, exactly. The indigenous and coastal communities also have long traditions of sustainable ocean stewardship. Do you agree?
I certainly do. I think that indigenous people and local communities they have practiced sustainable ocean stewardship for generations. They obviously have built such long-term relationships with the environment that they live in. They know the biodiversity hotspots, and they've been practicing different types of marine stewardship. Certainly in, I know, for example, in Madagascar, they have, and not just Madagascar, but throughout the world, they practice seasonal closures to try and allow certain marine species at sensitive times of the years to recoup. Within a context closer to us in East Africa, certainly in Tanzania, they have what they call the shahir, which are the fishery council leaders, and they're the ones who are regulate fishing and protecting key habitats.
What kind of conservation successes have you seen since you began your work in these areas?
I think some of the biggest traction in terms of conservation success has been around Nemba Island. We started a coral nursery in 2021 because we recognized that the reefs were being significantly degraded by the intense tourism pressure. So we started a nursery to try and propagate coral. And since then, we have planted thousands and thousands of what we call microcolonies onto the natural reefs to boost coral cover and also onto artificial structures. We also worked very, very closely with the Ministry of Blue Economy to establish a new protection area. And this was because the main reef was being so degraded. And at any one day, there could be 200 boats with tourists actually visiting this reef. So it was too much pressure. So what we did was, by implementing a special area, we could then impose higher conservation levies. But we also recognized that the boat operators should still get their revenue. So instead of 200 boats a day, there's now allowed to be only 8 boats a day. But instead of those tourists paying $3, they're paying $25 per person. So just that reduction in volume, but increase in revenue, has overall increased the conservation levies to that region by 500%. And 30% of that goes to the community, which is such a success because it shows them that conservation can work.
And it's very varied. It's not just coral reef nurseries, it's no-take zones. It's very varied approach to conservation, isn't it?
We have to have a multifaceted approach. We've also got what we call our eco-awareness program. So within our partner communities on northern Zanzibar, there are 14 partner communities, we are doing what we call our marine education curriculum. So trying to reach the small children so they grow up with that knowledge about how important marine conservation is.
And you told me in an earlier conversation about some super coral. Tell the listeners about those.
Certainly. So coral bleaching has been so devastating, but there is certainly glimmers of hope. And what researchers and restorers have identified are these heat-tolerant corals, and that we're calling them super corals. So these are the corals that, when a bleaching event happens, they are the species or genotypes that prove to be resilient or resisting. So they either don't bleach and turn white, or they can bounce back. So efforts are now focusing on trying to harvest these corals and use them to plant onto reefs so that they can build more resilient reefs for the future.
Obviously, there's still challenges. Just zoom out to the wider, looking at the UN's goal to protect 30% of the ocean by 2030. Do you believe this target is ambitious enough?
So I think it definitely was a really critical step forward to have 30% of the ocean protected by 2030. However, I don't know if it was ambitious enough. I think that it should not be a ceiling, and I hope it's not a ceiling. But given that we've got only 5 years left to reach 2030 and only 8% of the ocean is actually protected, I don't think we're going to reach that 30 by 30 goal. And I think that if governments and the politicians had actually said 50 by 30, perhaps now we would be sitting at 30%. So I think they could have been more ambitious, because time is running out.
And how do you think we could get governments to take action?
That is such a tricky question. And I'm not entirely sure I have the answer, because I think that fisheries are such a loaded industry. you know, they subsidized. And often those subsidies are pouring into an industry that is not making money. And we know that most of the world's fisheries are overexploited. But I don't think politicians want to take our cognizance. They don't want to acknowledge that. So I think awareness is all we can do, and advocating. And I think trying to work collaboratively on the ground and highlight the problems that we are facing. I mean, so a lot of people focus on plastic pollution. A lot of people focus on the global warming, the coral bleaching. A lot of people focus on the overfishing, which is really, really critical. But I think there are also a lot of other threats facing the ocean, like deep sea mining, where industries are harvesting precious metals and rare metals from the ocean floor. And those ocean floors are not just barren, they're full of life. They are hotspots as well, but they're being dredged and they're being destroyed, which is really bad. And also things like noise pollution. The sound is a really important component of marine animals' lives. And so ships and also things like sonar are interfering with whale migration routes. I think the problem is that the ocean is so vast, and when people see it, it's just this blue mass. So people aren't aware of these problems because you can't immediately see it. And I think that is a huge issue with threats facing the ocean. So many people don't know about them.
So it's people like you advocating and publicizing the problems that are surrounding the ocean. And if more people know more, then there is more of a pressure to write to your MP, to pressure your government to change things.
Absolutely. But I think also people can come immune to bad news. And I think that's such a fine balance, because people don't want to know about the bad news. They want to know about the beauty and the brilliance. So I think there's, as advocates for the ocean, I think we have to focus also on the beauty and what's still out there, and say that there's so much still to be discovered, but at the same time saying we're going to lose that really soon if we don't do something about it.
Okay, so on specific solutions, marine protected areas or MPAs are often mentioned as key. In your experience, are they working, or what more needs to be done?
Marine protected areas absolutely can work, and they are definitely recognized as one of the most effective tools for safeguarding marine biodiversity. During my studies, I showed that MPAs, particularly no-take zones, are so important for replenishing fish stocks. Unfortunately, if you do not have a well-managed or a regulated marine protected area, it's just a paper park. It's just they're designated in the regulations. So if you don't have strong enforcement, if you don't have inclusive governance where all stakeholders have bought into managing and protecting this marine protected area, then you're not going to have a successful MPA.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about just your experience of the sea. What's your favourite marine creature or species that you feel especially connected to, and why?
That's also a tough question, because my goodness, there are so many species and they are so varied and so beautiful. But I think off the top of my head, I would have to say that I'm very partial to octopuses. And that's because they are heavily overfished species, but they are really intelligent. And whenever I come across one on the reef, I'm really, really pleased to know that this is the one that possibly got away and escaped. They're masters of disguise, masters of mimicry. They can look like a rock instantly and then change color if you get too close, to show you these bright warning colors. And I think it's just the intelligence in their eyes and the way they look at you. So they're super smart. They can open jars and they can shapeshift and fit through the tiniest holes. So for me, they just represent something pretty special.
And what's a typical field day in your work? What does it look like?
So when I'm in the field, we try and start pretty early, grab that nice cup of coffee to get us going. But we do try and beat the wind and the wind. So starting early is a good thing. And then the team gathers, we'll load our equipment onto the boat, because that's most of the time we're actually going onto the ocean in our boats. And then it depends what we're doing. If we're going to go and do reef monitoring, we'll have our monitoring equipment, but it's obviously scuba. So we'll head off, spend several hours underwater monitoring reefs or monitoring seagrass beds. if we're going to be doing our underwater videos, then obviously we've got that equipment on board and we'll go off to specific sites. But it largely involves most of the morning out on the ocean, either on it or under it. And then in the afternoon, we'll come back. We'll obviously de-kit, wash the equipment, and then it's office time where we will spend downloading footage or just recording the data that we've just been monitoring on the reefs. We also do engagement with the local fishers, or we might go to the schools and do our eco awareness, telling them what we've just seen. So it's quite varied. It's lovely being in the field. It's lovely being hands-on and seeing actually what is going on in the water with those marine ecosystems.
And of course, I mean, you've been there since a child, so you kind of know, you've seen changes firsthand, haven't you?
I really have seen the changes, and particularly around one island, we've seen them change. And I think something called a phase shift where corals are dying and the algae is taking over. And this is a common phenomenon globally where, unfortunately, reefs are changing and losing their coral cover. And that's really significant because corals, what is the foundation of those ecosystems.
That's sad. Camilla, how do you stay hopeful?
You see, to be honest with you, I cannot imagine a world without coral reefs. I know that these ecosystems are so important for food security for millions of people. They provide coastline protection. They generate billions of dollars every year through tourism. And people or pharmaceutical companies are looking for medicines that can help with HIV and TB and cancer. But on a personal level, these are magical ecosystems that represent the beauty that is underwater. So I just don't ever want them to be lost, because as soon as I go underwater, I'm overwhelmed by the abundance, the colors, and the shapes. There's so much that we haven't found out about the ocean, not just coral reefs. And so I really don't give up hope, because I never want to lose this magical ecosystem.
And I think probably coral reefs, people think that they're not just pretty things. They are, you know, habitats for marine life, aren't they? Which
they are homes to
bigger and bigger along the food chain, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, they are so critical to ocean health and our health ultimately.
Yes, very, very true. Very true. And have you seen marine life bounce back?
That's a real tricky one. So because it's not just the local threats that we're trying to combat, it's also global threats. So we've definitely seen an improvement in the coral cover, and we feel that our nursery is having an impact in planting coral, and having our artificial structures is boosting marine life around Nemba. But last year, we had a significant bleaching event, where the corals have turned white from sea temperatures, elevated sea temperatures. And that was so tragic, because we lost so many corals within our coral nursery. On some of the reefs, 80% of the corals bleached. So we're just fighting fires on so many levels. You win some, you take a couple of steps back, but we keep moving forward. It's the only way we can go.
So thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your journey. But before we go, one final question for our listeners inspired by your work, but unsure where to start. So what is one small but powerful action that they could take today to stand up for the ocean?
I think that a lot of people don't realize that even if they don't live at the coast, if they don't live at the ocean, that their actions have a positive or negative impact. And plastic pollution, trash, is one of the biggest threats to marine life. And whatever lands on the ground ultimately goes into the rivers and then will end up in our oceans. So the one thing I can say, and it sounds old-fashioned, but people, I think, don't trash. And everyone thinks that picking up trash is somebody else's job or somebody else's problem. But I think if we could all be a little bit more ocean-minded about trash, just that simple thing of putting your trash in the right trash bin or picking it up would make a world of difference to reducing our plastic problem in the ocean.
Okay. Yes. Interest. Yes, definitely. I think that's valuable advice, and will resonate. Just it's the simple things, isn't it? Okay, well, Dr. Camilla Flores, it's been a true pleasure having you on our show. To all our listeners, thank you for listening to this Big Boat interview. This episode is a production by Boat International Media. Don't forget to tune in every week for news and updates from the Boat Briefing podcast, and we'll see you next time. Bye, Camilla.
Thanks so much, Lucy. Great to chat to you.